May it please the court, I appear on behalf of Alamo Lumber Company in a usury case which it won in the district court and lost in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals reversed the trial court and directed the entry of a judgment for penalties for usury, forfeiting over $100,000 in an admitted debt, plus interest on that amount, plus an additional $90,000 in further usury penalties, plus $25,000 attorney's fees. The total usury penalty or fine approaching $250,000. In doing that, the Court of Appeals stated, some very surprising, that the result unjustly enriched the plaintiffs as a result of their participation in a transaction which the plaintiffs, in the words of the court, formulated and nurtured, but a result which that court felt it had no alternative as an intermediate court to avoid. I say that that statement was surprising, not because it isn't true, it is a true statement on the substance of it, but it is seldom that you see such an express acknowledgement of an intermediate appellate court reaching what it conceives to be an unjust result and appearing to blame that on precedent. We believe that the court erred in its conclusion, not only in reaching that result, but in its apparent belief that the result was ordained by previous decisions of this court. The facts, very briefly, are these. Mrs. Addie Gold had an extensive pattern of benefiting her son, who is Stetson G. Bubba Reed, by quite a number of financial transactions, for a period which began long before and extended even after the transaction here in question. Originally, she gave him some lots in the town of Pleasanton that she owned, deeded them to him. Her son, Bubba, constructed some buildings on those lots. Mrs. Gold then borrowed $75,000 from a Pleasanton bank and secured that loan with some highway frontage that she owned, to $50,000 of which was paid directly by the bank to creditors of Bubba Reed to pay off debt that he had incurred in connection with the construction of that building. Another $25,000 was used to provide a stock of merchandise so that Mr. Reed could operate a tires, batteries, and accessories store in one of the buildings. Thus, the entire proceeds of that original $75,000 loan that Mrs. Gold took out went for the benefit of Bubba Reed. Eventually, that loan was not paid. The Pleasanton Bank renewed it once, but eventually threatened and began foreclosure proceedings. Then the evidence is such that the jury could have found in this case that Bubba Reed approached the Alamo Lumber Company with a plan, and that in doing so he was acting as agent for Mrs. Reed, Mrs. Gold. The plan that Bubba proposed as agent for Mrs. Gold was that if Alamo would buy the delinquent $75,000 note from the Pleasanton Bank and extend its maturity for a year, as another essential part of the plan, that Alamo would accept another note for about $30,000 to cover a $23,000 delinquent account at the lumber company and $7,000 in attorney's fees owed by Mrs. Gold in connection with the bank's foreclosure. Now, the $23,000 account was carried on the lumber company's books as the Stetson B. Reed-Gold account. The lumber company succumbed to that proposal, advanced the money to buy the note. No amounts were ever paid on either the $75,000 note or the $30,000 note. And for convenience in the argument, I'd like to refer to the $75,000 note as note one and the $30,000 note as note two. Eventually, Mrs. Gold sued Alamo for usury, claiming that note two was Bubba's debt, not hers, and because she was required to pay it as a condition to the lumber company agreeing to purchase and renew note one, it had to be treated as additional interest on note one, rendering the entire transaction usurious. Now, the evidence continued to show at the trial that even subsequent to the transaction here in question, Mrs. Gold had engaged in yet another transaction for her son's benefit, borrowing $125,000, this time from an Alice bank, using the same highway frontage as collateral, to create a corporation which purchased an oil products company from Mobil, of which her son Bubba was president and manager at a salary of $1,000 a month. Now, the jury findings. I think the critical jury finding here, certainly critical to the argument that Alamo is presenting to this court, is that in this transaction, Alamo did not intend to charge or contract for usurious interest. The transaction is not one which is usurious on its face. There's nothing wrong with note one and note two if you look at the face of those documents. They're perfectly regular. There is no thought, no suggestion of usury. The introduction of those documents would in no way raise an issue of usury. To get to the usury theory, you have to resort to extraneous evidence in an effort to show that note two did not have some independent valid purpose, but was simply a subterfuge, a device to provide a means to pay additional interest on note one. So the critical issue in the case is whether that was intended. And the jury found that it was not. There is sufficient evidence in this record to support the jury's finding, hence affirmance of the trial court and reversal of the Court of Appeals should follow. I say there's sufficient evidence to support the jury's finding on the no intent issue. I don't believe that the adequacy of that evidence was even attacked by Mrs. Gold as an appellant in the Court of Appeals. Mrs. Gold's argument has been throughout this case, and it was the error that the Court of Appeals fell into in adopting that argument, that intent is immaterial. Intent is material when the usury does not otherwise appear on the face of the instruments in question. The jury also found that Mrs. Gold's execution of note two was a condition to Alamo's willingness to purchase and renew note one. Certainly, that was the proposal, that was the transaction which was proposed by her son as Mrs. Gold's agent. Not surprisingly, the jury also found that Mrs. Gold and Bubba did not have a partnership or joint venture relationship, nor an intimate business relationship apart from kinship. I emphasize apart from kinship because I think that exclusionary phrase does, in those three words, probably best describe the relationship that did exist between Mrs. Gold and her son. Furthermore, the evidence shows that at least to the extent of $7,000, $7,000 of note two was advanced by Alamo to pay Mrs. Gold's attorney's fees in connection with the foreclosure proceedings begun by the Pleasanton Bank on note one. So that was her debt. There's no question there of her being required to pay Bubba's debt with respect to that. As to the $23,000 balance of the lumber company account, the jury was entitled to find from this evidence that that was either a joint debt of the two of them, or that Mrs. Gold intended by this transaction to once again benefit her son Bubba by assuming it, consistent with the pattern of gifts and financial support which extended both before and after this transaction. In other words, that note two was not intended as a subterfuge for interest on note one, but that the entire transaction in its entirety sufficiently benefited both Mrs. Gold and her son Bubba to persuade the jury that note two was not intended as additional interest for note one. And I say persuade the jury because the jury listened to the evidence and found no intent. The jury was persuaded. So as it comes to this court, there are two opposing contentions presented. Mrs. Gold's contention appears to be that whenever a transaction is presented which involves both an extension of credit to a borrower, such as note one in this case, and in the same transaction the assumption of a debt which to some extent is at least nominally the debt of another, then usury is shown as a matter of law and intent is immaterial. A sort of strict liability argument in the usury area, that once you do it, you're over, you've lost. If that transaction can be viewed as X assuming Y's debt, usury is committed. It doesn't make any difference what the intention of the parties is. The lawsuit is over, the penalties are collected and imposed, and everyone goes home. To the contrary, Alamo asserts that such a transaction is usurious only if the plaintiff fulfills his or her burden of showing as a part of the plaintiff's case that the assumption of the second debt was intended by the parties to be interest on the first. The rule that Alamo asserts is should be the law. We really assert that it is the law, clearly, avoids unjust and dogmatic results with resulting traps for the unwary and catch-22s, and remains perfectly consistent with sound principles of usury law by enabling usury to be found when the plaintiff can show intent in such a situation. We submit that our argument, as the decisions of this court consistently do, place substance over form. The substance of this transaction was not that note two was interest for note one. Accordingly, no usury is shown. Now, we've cited in the brief an excellent symposium that appears in the St. Mary's Law Journal concerning Texas interest law, usury law. The writers there point out that on the issue of intent in usury cases, when the contract is usurious on its face and a showing of actual subjective intent on the part of the parties engaging in the transaction is not required. Simple case, if the note provides for 18% interest, the maximum rate is 10. This court has correctly held that the parties will not be able to say, oh, I didn't intend that. I didn't intend usury. Sure, I intended 18%, but I didn't intend to commit usury, even though 18% is usurious. That won't work, because the usury is displayed on the face of the document. It's difficult to say whether usury is or is not an element. I would prefer to view it as saying, yes, usury is an element, but the intent is an element, but the intent is shown on the face of the instrument in that kind of usury claim, and the plaintiff does not have to prove more than we've got an 18% figure filled in the note when the maximum legal rate is 10%. But in a transaction such as this, when the documents are perfectly normal, perfectly fine on their face, and it's necessary to resort to an extraneous theory that whores the face of the record of these instruments, you've got to show that the parties here came up with a transaction which looks good, but they really intended this other note to be additional interest for note one. In that event, clearly the plaintiff has to move, as a part of his case, that intent. I believe the St. Mary's review of the cases clearly lays out that that's the law in Texas. Court's 1979 Cochran decision has some language in it to the effect that subjective intent is immaterial when usury is shown on the face of the contract or transaction. We have no quarrel with that. It is immaterial in that event. The case upon which we rely, and concerning which we don't think there's any real argument from the respondent, is an opinion by the Dallas Court of Appeals in American Century Mortgage Investors versus Regional Center. It's an opinion by Justice Guittard. It's an NRE case, but I believe the language from this part of the opinion certainly accurately and correctly states the law of Texas. That opinion is critical because the jury instruction in this case was taken directly from the language of the opinion. The jury was told what interest is, told what usury is, and then was instructed that usury is a matter of intention. And you read the case, you read the instruction, does not see intervening authority, say, Guittard in his opinion, but it is there word for word. Unless the loan makers show on their face an intention to charge in at a greater rate than admitted by law, then the burden is a party pleading usury to show the existence of some agreement device or subterfuge to charge usury. And both parties had that in common pledge. The transaction is not usurious unless the lender also supposed and intended it to be. Now that was the instruction that this jury received. Able counsel argued all of the facts that have been argued laboriously in the briefs before this court to that jury. The relationship, the financial relationship between Mrs. Gold and her son, the nuances that could be drawn from this, what it was that was intended or not intended by the parties. Mrs. Gold's counsel certainly argued that, oh no, this was a subterfuge by the lumber company to charge more interest. The jury answered the question, no. Now, an appellate court should not disturb Alamo's victory before that jury. And I don't understand the Beaumont court to challenge the adequacy of that jury finding, but simply erroneously and mistakenly to have held that intent is not an element, when obviously it is in cases of this kind. Now, I don't want to be understood as arguing to this court that it could never be usury as a matter of law to require someone to pay someone else's debt as a condition to getting a loan. If I went down to East 6th Street this afternoon and walked into a small loan company, and the man there said he really could not afford to lend me the $200 I needed at today's interest rates, but that he could charge me the highest rate allowed by law on the $200, and he'd make me the loan. If I picked up one of these old no-good notes that he had in his file over here and paid that off also, certainly a jury could find on those facts that that man had charged me more than the law allowed by requiring me to pay not only the maximum rate, but also to buy from him something else, this old no-good note that he had. The principle is sound. But just as other legal principles, there are cases in which there is a range in which the facts are for jury determination. And here, once again, the jury looked at these facts and said, no, that was not the intent. Note 2 had an independent purpose other than as a subterfuge for usury. The Laid Right decision that the Court of Civil Appeals, no writ case that respondent and the Court of Appeals make quite a bit of, certainly is not wrongly decided on its facts. It dealt with a complicated situation in which a borrower said that he was asked to assume personally debts of corporations. The Laid Right Court simply held that, well, the trial court should not have directed a verdict in that case, that the case should be remanded for trial because the plaintiff needs to be given an opportunity to show that that amounted to usury. But clearly on retrial in Laid Right, the defendant there could show, perhaps, that these other corporations were ones in which the plaintiff was the sole owner, or that it was a benefit to him to make loans to those corporations, or that it was not intended for any variety of reasons that the transaction be a disguise or a subterfuge for usury. The distinction is here that we're in the second phase. The jury has looked at these facts and found no usurious intent. The better rule, in fact, the Texas rule, is that there is no usury where there is an independent reason or purpose for the issuance of this other note, which provides an explanation which is satisfactory to the jury on the question of intent. Out-of-state cases don't provide enormous assistance, and it's probably not necessary for this court to look out-of-state to decide this rather simple case as we view it. The lead case in the ALR annotation is this New Mexico opinion in McCullough against Snow, which once again provides an excellent example of what we're arguing for here today. There, a developer assumes of a builder who was building houses in his subdivision. He did that because he didn't want those houses to get tied up in liens and lawsuits and sit there empty. He wanted to see houses sold in his development. So the New Mexico court said, well, we can see the benefit to the developer there of assuming those debts, and we accept that explanation. That is an adequate explanation as to why that is not a subterfuge or a disguise for usury. So that assumption of that debt was not intended as additional interest on another debt of the developer. What the Court of Appeals got off on in this case, where it made its mistake, is in looking at a statutory defense to usury for accident or mistake. that is the only statutory defense if the party accused of usury is more or less convicted of it, but he shows that the note was filled in with 18% because the typist struck the wrong key on the typewriter and 10 was actually intended, fine. But you don't reach the accident or defense matter until the plaintiff has shown the elements of her case to begin with. And in this case, there was a failure on that essential element of intent because it was not shown on the face of the instrument.
Is intent discussed at all in wage writing?
I don't recall the use of the words, Your Honor. I believe that it was implicitly so because the court remanded the case for trial on the factual issues which existed, and those factual issues were alter ego, whether these corporations were acting one and for each other, and secondly, whether this was usury. Now, to my reading of Laid Right, that means whether this was intended. When you have a transaction such as this, which is subject to one or more innocent, non-usurious interpretations, but could have been usury, then clearly the test is intent. That's the proper test, that's a good test, it's a manageable test. Unlike the wording usury cases where there is no standard to check a lender's subsequent denial that he intended what he to do, what he plainly did, here, whether note 2 was meant as interest is the whole point of the case. The jury once again decided that issue in Alamo's favor. It is not an immaterial issue, as the Beaumont Court erroneously held. Accordingly, this court should reverse the decision of the Beaumont Court and affirm the judgment of the trial court. Any questions I can have? Thank you.
We'll hear response from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Dennis Drake present arguments for respondent.
May it please the court, Your Honor, Dennis Drake for the respondent, Addie B. Gold. This court has granted writ of error in this case on point of error number one, which stated that Addie B. Gold failed to meet her burden of proof because the Court of Civil Appeals disregarded factors in their favor for Alamo Lumber Company. Addie Gold met her burden of proof in a usury case, as well-established Texas law so holds. Once she met and proved, and it was established what the agreement of the parties was in this case, the agreement of the parties in this case is without dispute. She was required to assume a $23,000 debt of her son, his bad debt that was going into bankruptcy. It's been categorized by opposing counsel as note number one and note number two. Note number one was her $75,000 debt, and it was her debt and only her debt. She was the only obligor on that note to the Pleasanton Bank that she executed in 1974. It was her property in San Antonio, not Bubba's property, her son, that was pledged as security and mortgage for that loan to the Pleasanton Bank. And here's the $75,000 note that she's responsible for. And admittedly, she gave those proceeds to her son. She testified at trial. She gave the proceeds of that note to her son to help him out in his business venture in Pleasanton. But there was never any testimony, never any evidence introduced at the trial of this case that that was a loan to Bubba or that he owed her the money back or that that was a gift. Is there something wrong with a mother making a gift of loan proceeds? 1 year later, approximately, Alamo Lumber Company finds that it's has a $23,000 debt of the son on an open, unsecured account for building materials that Alamo Lumber Company knows is going into bankruptcy. And it's in the record. that it was going into bankruptcy, and Alamo knew that Bubba was in bankruptcy proceedings and that debt would most likely be discharged. At that point, whoever formulated the deal, and that is not who formulated the transactions disputed, but it's not necessary to decide this case because it's irrelevant as a legal issue. Alamo made an express condition that Mrs. Gold would assume the bad debt of her son, the $23,000 obligation, before they would go purchase the $75,000 note from the Pleasanton Bank across the street. In fact, the testimony shows they required her to sign note number two, her son's bad debt, for $23,000, before they would go purchase the note from the bank and give her additional time to pay off that note to the Pleasanton Bank and thereby save her home from certain foreclosure in San Antonio. Those are the undisputed facts in this case. That is the agreement. So what it boils down to is, where are we on the issue of intent? That was the issue that was asked. Are there any defenses once we met that burden of showing that under laid right, the assumption of another person's debt is deemed interest, therefore it's taken out of a subterfuge, scheme, or device because it's deemed interest?
Counsel, if I owe $20,000 at the bank and I can't make the payment, and I go to the bank and I say, I need six more months, and the bank say, well, that's just fine. We'll give you 6 months if you'll just go over here and have Mr. John Smith sign this note with you. Now, this is a third party. Is that interest?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't think in that instance it would be interest, because that's some type of additional, it's a guarantor type situation where...
Just signs the note with me. Doesn't put a nickel in,
but
it just signs the note.
I understand, Your Honor, but it's the same lender that's involved here, the same lender of funds. And remember, the definition of, or I would point out to the court that the distinction is the definition of interest is compensation allowed for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. Here you have the same lender who's already loaned the money. All they're seeking is additional guarantee-type situation or a guarantor-type situation for the additional time, but they're not requiring the borrower to assume another person's obligation.
What if you had a joint venture, or say a partnership of four or five individuals, and they were putting on this same housing project in Pleasanton, and we'll say there was five individuals involved. They each go down to the bank, they borrow $100,000 to put this project together. Individual notes, individual securities. The project goes sour, two of them can't come up. The other three go in. And so we want to save this project. We've got good security. We want to renew our $100,000 notes, three of them. And the banker says, fellas, I can't do that because you've got $200,000 that's outstanding here that you can't come up. Now, I'll help you save your project if you take over those, if you assume the entire indebtedness. Is that a usurious transaction?
No, Your Honor. It's not a usurious transaction because it's a joint venture.
I'm not talking about a joint venture. I'm talking about five individuals going in and borrowing money separately on a single project. Now, that might be a joint venture as to the five that's going in, but they are individually financed.
I see, Your Honor. I misunderstood the question. Excuse me. I thought that, in other words, these are separate individuals, and they're not in business together, and they're not a partnership, and they're not a joint venture. Is that
except
right?
As to this housing project, this one housing project.
Then, Your Honor, I think by definition, if I may say so, that the if they're going to share in the profits by putting their combined monies into this project, then I think by some legal definition that would become some type of community of interest to be gained from contributing to the
partnership
funds.
Debt, in other words.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that would be within the realm by legal definition. If they're all contributing funds for the same venture, that would be some type of partnership or joint venture.
Now, you would say it's usurious if each of those five were individually building houses in the same addition. And then the bank says, say, fellas,
you want to say these other two guys out here, you got to assume their notes that they'd be usurers, wouldn't you?
I would say that, yes, Your Honor. This, after the agreement was established by Mrs. Gold, there's judicial admissions. They cannot dispute what the agreement was. Alamo Lumber Company can't do that. It's in their pleadings. It's in 14, testified to 14 different times by their vice president, and there's a jury issue that found that this was a requirement. And the specific sums are set out in their own brief to both the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals and this court. Once that agreement was established, under the laid right rule, the assumption of another's debt is automatically deemed interest. Therefore, what would be the defenses that Alamo could come up with? Do they have any defenses if that's a correct rule of law, which I think is certainly in line with the legislative declared intent for this type of credit transaction? Partnership, joint venture, or intimate business relationship, whatever that is. Those were the issues that were submitted to the jury. Those would have been defenses, and why would they have been defenses? Because it wouldn't have been the assumption of somebody else's debt. It would have been a joint debt of both the parties. It would have been a community debt, and therefore it wouldn't have been a usurious transaction because it was a common debt, not separate independent debt. Those issues were foreclosed when the jury said there was no partnership, joint venture, or intimate, or any other intimate-type business relationship. Therefore, was there bona fide error, accidental or bona fide error? This court has repeatedly said in usury cases, culminating in Cochran, that intent to charge a usurious rate of interest is never the test. It's never an element of proof in a usury case. The statute says any person who charges, contracts for, or receives interest in excess of law, allowed by law, is usury. That's the legislative definition. It doesn't say any person who intentionally or knowingly charges an excessive rate of interest. That's not an element of proof under the statute. In this court, this is not cited in any of my briefs to the court, this court recently, in Tri-County Farmers Co-op versus Bendley in October of 1982, said that bona fide error has to be a threshold plea. It was never pled, established, proven, issues submitted on it at the trial of this case by Alamo Lumber Company.
What issue was?
The issue of bona fide, defense of bona fide error, Your Honor. It was never pled, proven, any evidence at all established or any issues submitted on it to the jury. And I was pointing out to the court in this most recent decision that is a threshold pleading that has to be pled.
Counsel, help me with this. Now we've got note one for $75,000 and Alamo takes its $75,000 and goes and buys that from the bank.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. That is a transaction that, if you say, puts Alamo in the posture of a lender.
That's correct.
Now, note number two.
Your Honor, I would wish to clarify that in one respect, and that is to point out to the court that in no way am I saying that Alamo Lumber Company would not have a right in ordinary commerce, as would anybody, to go buy a note from somebody. That happens every day.
Well, this is where I'm aimed at.
All right.
All right. They go and buy a note. That transaction of standing alone, it's clean.
Completely valid, yes.
All right. Alamo furnishes $22,000 worth of supplies, materials, on an open account to Bubba. They say, Bubba, I want you to give me a note for this. And I want your mother to sign that note, and I want to add to this the attorney fees that your mother owes us. Now my question is, how do we tie note one and note two together? Now note two may have usurious interest because it has required the mother to sign the note, including $7,000. But now, how does that spill over onto note one?
First of all, Your Honor, I think the time sequence of that transaction is important. You couched the question to me, what is wrong with Alamo buying the note and then going to Bubba and saying, or whoever arranged it, would you get your mother to sign the second note for your debt? The transaction here was is that they first of all made it an express condition before they would buy the note. The $75,000 note, note number one, Mrs. Gold's debt, which was in default. Therefore, they had not already bought the note. They made it an express condition, a requirement, that before they would buy the note, she would have to assume her son's bad debt for $23,000.
Or after. Note number two seems to me to be a different proposition from note number one.
It isn't, Your Honor, but the purchase of note number two is made, or the execution of note number two is made conditional, an express requirement on having to purchase note number one, which in note number two incorporates the debt of somebody else, which she was not legally responsible to pay. Therefore, as a matter of law, it would be deemed interest. It's the compensation for use, forbearance, or detention of money. What consideration would there be there to Mrs. Gold?
I'm saying, note number two may be the usurious. But how does that involve note number one over here? They went out and they bought that note for $75,000 and paid for it.
I understand. What you're saying, if I understand the question, Chief Justice, is why wouldn't note number one remain valid? Is that essentially
yes.
What the question is?
Yes.
Because they never agreed to buy note number one, Alamo Lumber Company. They wouldn't have ever bought it unless she first agreed to assume her son's bad debt. That was the condition that made it usurious. Otherwise, there'd be no problem. But this, perhaps I can put it best this way. What is the transaction that is a usurious here? Is it the buying by Alamo Lumber Company of the $75,000 note? No, that is not what made the usury here. It's the agreement that makes it usurious. It's the transaction. And the law says it's a transaction is usurious from its inception of the agreement. The inception of the transaction is what causes the usurious agreement. It wasn't a $75,000 note. It was the contractual stipulation or express condition that this note would not be bought unless it was made a part of note number two.
If I understood it more clearly, I could ask a better question, I'm sure. Ms. Gold she owed the $75,000.
She owed.
And the bank goes and buys the note. Now, the bank says, I want Ms. Gold to sign the $22,000 note also. Now, that, it would seem to me, under laid rights, is the note that, if it's usurious, would be the one that's usurious. Because Ms. Gold has never been on that note before. And now she is being required to sign the note. Are these things separable?
No, Your Honor, they're not separable. This is an intertwined, connected transaction. The transaction involves both notes. They cannot be separated. If they were able to be separated, it would be okay, Your Honor. But these were made express conditions. They did not go out. I think the time element is important. They did not go out and buy the note. Your Honor, if I may refer the court to the exact testimony of Mr. Collins, the vice president of Alamo Lumber Company at tab 5. In the brief, my brief to the court, it says, and you've also testified, Mr. Collins, that without Mrs. Gold signing note number 2 on plaintiff's exhibit number 8, that Alamo Lumber Company would not have purchased the first note number 1. Is that correct? That's correct. The question is, Mr. Collins, would Alamo Lumber Company have purchased the $75,000 note and given Mrs. Gold additional time to pay it off had she not signed number 2? I have answered that before, and the answer is no. Your Honor, the agreement here is the transactional aspect that they're trying to put on this agreement is that our burden of proof is somehow different because this isn't a wording case. But once there's no dispute as to what the agreement was, the intermingling of these two separate notes having to be made conditional upon each other, then there's no dispute as to where the usury is. And if I may point out to the court, both in the Laid Right decision, which was a transactional type usury case, it was a renewal and extension of other notes. There was no question about the usury. The point of law stayed the same. What the court remanded that back to the trial court for was to determine whether the lender, the corporate lender and the corporate payee, were the alter egos of each other.
What you're really saying is that intent is conclusively presumed when you require someone else to pick up that extra note.
That's correct. Your Honor, the intent, or at least the agreement of the parties here, is that purchase of the other note, the assumption of another person's debt, automatically is deemed interest once that transaction happens, and therefore it's not necessary to find an issue on intent. And it was an irrelevant issue that was submitted to the jury.
And the reason you don't have to find intent is because it is presumed.
That's correct, and that's what Laid Right says, Your Honor, that intent is presumed and it's deemed interest. But the agreement here, Your Honor, is the interrelation of the two notes. How did this double usury occur? It's to take this agreement and hold it up to the light of what how much interest could be charged on this transaction. Not as a severable transaction, because that wasn't the transaction. The transaction was conditioned and made an express condition. And the jury so found that it was an express condition that before they would buy that $75,000 note, note number one, she had to assume that bad debt. And if that's made the condition, then it's automatically going to be compensation for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. And that compensation for the use, forbearance, or detention of money is somebody else's debt that she didn't owe. That's my understanding of Laid Right. And that's my understanding of the principle in Stevens. And the reason both those cases were sent back was for issues of whether the lender required the assumption of another party's debt as a condition for making that loan.
In your answer, you say that the only time that you could not have usury is when there is a bona fide error. Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, I believe what I said there is that under the statute, certainly bona fide error is a defense.
No, the only valid statutory defense to usury is bona fide error occurs at page.
I stand by that statement, Your Honor. The only valid statutory defense is bona fide error. However, that can be modified somewhat in a case where we are dealing with a principle that says that principle of law that says the assumption of another party's debt is deemed interest. And in that case, when we say that, if there's something that makes the assumed debt of another party not another party's debt, but the same, it makes the debt a joint debt of both parties, such as a partnership or a joint venture agreement, then that would be a defense in my estimation. But those were foreclosed. I stand by the only statutory defense would be a bona fide error, but if the principle of law is the assumption of another party's debt is deemed interest, then that no longer applies.
You just flat disagree with the Dallas court opinion that intent is essential here.
I believe this court flat disagrees with the principle stated that intent is an element of usury, as so stated in Cochran. But the American Century case can be squared with the established law on defensive issues, because what they're really talking about there, the facts in that situation was the bank was going to lend and thought it was going to lend its money to a corporation at the allowable higher interest rate, and it was really lent to a partnership. Therefore, I think it would have been a much easier time for us all in the usury area if it would have been a bona fide error instead of saying intent. Because, as I read it, this court has many times stated that intent to charge usury or contract for usury is a subjective test, and that is never to be the test in a usury case. So therefore, I think the principle of American Century was correctly decided. But I think the language they used on intent is somewhat confusing, but I think it can be squared with the law. At this point, I would like to categorize the language that opposing counsel started off by citing the unjust enrichment language that was used in the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals. Frankly, that bothered me a great deal when I read the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals opinion for two reasons. First of all, in the if we're talking about some type of equitable concept, then it bothers me that in some way this corporation is saying that it was somehow defrauded or that there was some unjust enrichment to the borrower here, when what we're really talking about is what is the reason that they made this loan? Was it to go out and just save somebody's home from
foreclosure? Well, they're trying to collect $22,000, and they end up paying $250,000 for it. That's more than triple damage.
Your Honor, but is it to be couched as unjust enrichment when the legislative has declared legislative intent?
I understand the legislative penalty for usury is not anything like that.
I don't understand that, Your Honor. Excuse me, I thought that the
penalties set by statute for usury are not 10 times. That's what it costs for the $22,000 debt.
Your Honor, the mathematical calculation is that they charged over two times the amount of authorized legal interest in
this
transaction. On the
$22,000 debt. That's why the question related to the $75,000. $75,000 was a separate deal. They paid $75,000.
Well, Your Honor, in that case, if the court, I don't agree that the two notes aren't related, but if that's the interpretation, then on that $22,000 debt which she was required to
assume. I was just trying to explain the Court of Appeals statement. You said you didn't understand it. I was trying to explain it.
Oh, excuse me.
The way I understood it.
Or stated another thing that might have been on the Court of Civil Appeals' mind was is that Alamo actually spent $75,000 of its money. It then sold $23,000 of its goods, and it paid a lawyer $7,000 for a total of about $106,000 that Alamo was out in cash. And having done that, they wind up owing $250,000.
Your Honor, all I can say is that the agreement was made. They entered into the agreement, and as far as I understand the law, intent is not an element of reaching that agreement. It's what did the parties bargain to do? Alamo certainly intended to receive a benefit here. They thought that they would recoup their bad debt from Bubba by having her assume a debt she didn't owe, that this other debt they required her to sign, the second debt, was secured by her land in San Antonio, that they treated it as one transaction when they took the $7,000 attorney's fees that were paid to the Pleasanton Bank and wrapped it into that second note. They didn't add it to the first note. That's further evidence that the transaction was treated as one. And in the appendix on tab 6 of my brief to the court, I would draw attention to the letter of Mr. Collins on December 30th, 1977, and Mrs. Gold, where it shows exactly how they charged interest on the notes and treated the transaction as one by including the attorney's fees in note number two. And the attorney's fees related to the purchase of note number one. But the agreement of the parties is what controls here. And if that agreement does not withstand the test of whether more interest than is allowed by law, then those severe penalties are to be imposed. And it's been stated by this court many times in the Court of Civil Appeals that those penalties are severe. But if that's what happens when you expose the agreement to whether or not over twice the amount of interest has been charged, then that penalty, the legislature says, shall be imposed. And I'm not coming before this court saying that the penalties aren't severe, but I'm not sure that they're necessarily unjust if that's what the law provides for. The other issues, therefore, are if Alamo did not plea and prove the statutory defense, which was bona fide error, if they did not get affirmative findings, which they did not, on transaction, on partnership, joint venture, or intimate business relationship, then the only thing that is left is intent, which I believe is a defective issue. And they threw that intent net out into the waters and tried to pull in any type of legal defense that they could catch with that. They say it could have been her debt. It could have been some type of guarantor surety agreement. There's no evidence of that. That would be an affirmative pleading. It was never pled, ever. They said it for the first time in this court that it could have been in some way her debt, that it could have been a benefit to her. How is it a benefit to her to assume a bad debt that was ultimately going to be discharged in bankruptcy for her to assume it? Mrs. Gold said she didn't want to assume it. That was the condition to save her home. She didn't want to have to assume her son's bad debt. And what is...
You finish your sentence, counsel.
I was just about to say, Your Honor, that the principle of law announced in Laidright is in complete accordance with the declared legislative intent. I believe that to allow creditors to have this loophole based merely on some type of family relationship would go against the legislative intent to prevent credit abuse. Thank you.
Reply from the petitioner.
May it please the court. The law is an instrument of justice, and this court sits to apply the law in order to achieve justice. It disturbs
counsel,
me.
Counsel, we administer justice under the law.
And I have enough respect for the law, Your Honor, to believe that the law is intended to be an instrument of justice. It may not always work out that way, but it bothers me to hear an argument presented to this court that this is an unjust result, but it's the law. If it's an unjust result, why is that the law? It isn't the law. The law is that interest cannot exceed a certain amount. Now, there's a threshold question in this case as to whether note 2 is interest. You don't even get to the question of a defense to usury until you decide whether there's anything here that could even be said to be usury. Now, I think one thing that has been clearly overlooked is the $7,000 of note 2 that went to the Pleasanton Bank, not to the Alamo Lumber Company, but to pay the attorneys for the Pleasanton Bank for Mrs. Gold's attorney's fees incurred in connection with their proceedings. That's Mrs. Gold's debt. And yet that element has gotten wrapped up in this tremendous doubling and tripling and forfeiting, which results in the $250,000. That couldn't even be contended to be not Mrs. Gold's debt.
Whether it's $30,000 or $23,000, still usurious.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is, because if you look at the 23, the question there is, was that interest in this transaction?
Well, I mean, if we assume it was interest, it's usurious.
Your Honor, if you assume that it's interest, I believe that is an error of law in making that assumption. It's a part of the plaintiff's case to prove that that note is interest. And that requires an intention on the part of the parties to that transaction that that note be interest. Counsel began his argument by saying, is there something wrong with a mother making a gift to her son? Certainly not, and this mother has made a lot of gifts to this son. Why is it that the jury couldn't find that she intended to make him another gift of the by paying off his $23,000 note at the account at the lumber company? That it was not intended as interest by Mrs. Gold or by anyone else at the time of this transaction. If we start talking about going into the bank and what the banker says and so forth, I'd like to deal with that, but I'd first like to direct the court's attention back to the facts of this case. And I think that we're entitled to look at those facts most favorably to the lumber company because the jury resolved that issue of intent in our favor. Bubba Reed, a law school graduate, he prepared legal papers, he maintained an office with a practicing lawyer at the time of this transaction. The jury could have found that he originated this transaction, that he presented it in its entirety to the lumber company, both note one and note two. Now, to me, that's relevant on the question of whether note two was intended as interest. This is not a situation of a banker suggesting that somebody else's note be paid. This is a situation where, as the Court of Appeals says, where these parties who are now claiming interest formulated and nurtured this transaction, disguised it, set it up, and then sprang a trap. The answer to it is that Alamo did not intend this, no matter what set of clothes might be put on it now, as interest. They intended it for what it was, a separate transaction in which they would lend Mrs. Gold another $7,000 in addition to the $75,000 they needed to buy the note from the Pleasanton Bank so she could pay her bill at the attorney's office. They would also clear this account from their books, which I think the jury could have found from the evidence was either a joint account or one which Mrs. Gold intended to pay for the benefit of her son Bubba, not as additional interest to the Alamo Lumber Company. There's no reason for this court to get into the imposition of automatic rules of liability for usury. If you do this, if you say the bad word, if you think the bad thought, you've automatically incurred thousands of dollars of penalties regardless of intent. That's not the law. It's never been the law. And it shouldn't become the law in this state. In the banker situation, I think if you had your five participants, no partnership, simply five different investments in a given development, the banker suggested that the three who wanted to go ahead assume the debts of two of the defaulters as a condition to making a loan, I think you'd have a jury question. I don't mind telling this court that you'd have a jury question in that event. I don't think you would have an automatic motion for summary judgment, directed verdict situation either way. But I point out to the court that this case has been tried, and this jury heard this evidence and decided that in this set of facts, usury was not intended. Now that ought to be enough. That's all that the law has ever required. We don't reach the question of a defense to usury until the plaintiff has established that usury even occurred in the first place. And that requires a finding that note two was intended as interest on note one. I think the question the Chief Justice asked concerning the $75,000 note, which was purchased by Alamo from the Pleasanton Bank, that has been raised throughout by Alamo in the Court of Appeals and in this case as involving an antecedent bona fide debt that is no way involved in this transaction. the lumber company simply purchased the $75,000 note. And clearly the principal of that note and the interest on that note should in no event be forfeited. But I don't want to settle for that. I'll take that if that's all I can get. But I'm here arguing to the court that it's unjust, it's unright, it's unlawful to say that this jury can't decide that note 2 was not intended by these parties as interest, and that it's all right for a court on appeal to say that parties after a transaction can characterize a situation such as this as usury, and just because it could be usury, say that automatic liability occurs. I find that to be a shocking result, and I think it's one that this court ought not to allow. We don't reach the question of presumptions. There isn't anything in Lade Wright that says that any intent is presumed. The plaintiff lost in Lade Wright. And in the Lade Wright court says that the plaintiff there had a point that says that usury is established as a matter of law. Much the same argument that's being made here. And the Lade Wright court said, we overrule that point. What they did say was that the trial court should not have directed a verdict. And we remand the case, we remand the Lade Wright case for a jury determination. But we've got the jury determination here. Who formulated the transaction is relevant. All of these facts and circumstances are relevant. It is only contracts for interest in excess of 10% that are illegal. It's the plaintiff's burden to show that there is some interest in excess of 10%. Whether note 2 is interest is a question of intent. And that question of intent was answered in Alamo's favor by the jury. The Triton case that was cited by counsel, in, as the court will recall, simply involved the question of whether there had been a contract between merchants to pay interest above the 6% rate that the law presumes in the absence of a contract. That case had nothing to do with the issues presented here. There is no conflict between any decision of this court, including particularly the Cochrane decision, and the plain, correct, consistent language of the Dallas Court of Appeals, which was quoted and read to this jury, and which this jury used to find that note 2 was not intended as interest. That this whole thing borders on I won't say that, but this whole situation is a construction that the plaintiffs themselves formulated and nurtured as virtually a trap for the unwary, presented it to Alamo, and then turned around and tried to dress it up in a different set of clothes 2 or 3 years later when the debts weren't paid. The result is unjust. Beyond that, the result is erroneous in law. And to reverse this case on appeal and to say that this jury in Bexar County can't see through this and brand this for what it is would be a further injustice. I urge the court to affirm the decision of the trial court.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted upon the briefs and the oral arguments.